Good day and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Kate Harner. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's 2014 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team with Cigna. Due to the format of the call today, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, there will be a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback on your experience of today's seminar. After that survey, you will be able to ask questions of today's speaker. A handout for the presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Eating Disorders and Adolescence. Once again, visit the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation materials in blue entitled Eating Disorders and Adolescence. Please also notice the blue square in the top section of the page that you may click on to sign up for future seminars. It's not required that you sign up in order to attend each month. However, if you choose to sign up, you will receive email reminders for each month's presentation. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker, Dr. Jillian Lampert. Dr. Lampert is the Senior Director at the EMILY Program. Today, she will be sharing information with us on adolescence and eating disorders. Welcome, Dr. Lampert.
Thank you, Kate. And thank you for joining today, everybody. I'm excited to speak to you about this topic. I've been working in the field of eating disorders for about 20 years, and I think that some of the most worry-filled questions I get are from parents wondering if their adolescent is struggling with an eating disorder or not, having questions about the sort of behavior they see in their adolescent or perhaps one of a friend of an adolescent. Just really wondering, is this a problem and what should I do about it? So hopefully at the end of today, we'll have some of those questions answered if those are some of your particular questions. And I hope to give you a lot of information today and some resources in terms of where you can get some more information. So I'm going to dive into our presentation, and I welcome your questions at the end and hope that I meet your needs with this session. So the objectives are really to talk about the different types of eating disorders, understand when it's appropriate to seek a specialist intervention for the treatment of an eating disorder or the assessment of a potential eating disorder, and talk a little bit about treatment and interventions for eating disorders, and then talk a bit about how people can support adolescents in treatment for an eating disorder, because it is can be a confusing time, and sometimes people struggle with wondering what to do, what to say, how to say it, and how to really engage in a supportive role. So let's start out with some statistics. And as I go through the presentation, I'll let you know which slide I'm on so you can follow along. And a lot of the slides are for your further information, and I'll highlight some points on them as we go. So if we start with the general statistics slide, it's really an incredible issue in our country that about 20 million women and 10 million men suffer from clinically significant eating disorders sometime in their life, which boils down to about 6% of women and 3% of men. When you apply that to adolescents, the numbers are a little higher, about 8% of adolescent females and 4% of adolescent males. And those are the percentages of adolescents that would be diagnosed with a clinical eating disorder. Keep in mind that there are a lot of behaviors that adolescents exhibit which would make those percentages much higher if we were really just looking at behaviors. So we don't want to limit this just to the 8% of adolescent females and 4% of adolescent males, but really started thinking about what is it that adolescents do with their food and their weight and their eating and their coping, and how can we be aware of when there's a problem and how we intervene. So with that setting, we also know that of those adolescents with eating disorders, about 50% of adolescents who met full criteria for an eating disorder have never talked about their concerns, despite having contact with a healthcare provider, and their families haven't talked to anybody about the concerns. So we know that prevention and early intervention is critical, and we know that people need increased awareness of healthcare providers, and increased awareness of seeking help. So we know that it's critical that we get the information out there and start talking about what eating disorders are, who gets them, what they are, why they happen, and all of that. So we'll move into that section of the presentation, really talking about, you know, why do people get eating disorders, who are the people that get them, what are they? And if you look at this slide six, that has three bubbles on it, the title, Why Do People Get Eating Disorders, it's really understood by a biopsychosocial model, which means there's some biology, some psychology, and some social environmental factors. And I think of this picture a lot when a parent asks me, well, I don't understand why my child has an eating disorder. This image comes to mind. And I think there are these three bubbles, and they overlap. And the space and the overlap gives us some idea who's likely to struggle with an eating disorder, who's more likely to struggle than somebody else. So when you look at the bubbles one at a time, we'll walk through them briefly and then see how the interlapping of the bubbles really out of that can give rise to an eating disorder. So we have this social environment bubble first. We all live in an environment that's very focused on what we look like, what our weight is, how we are as a person is often tied to how we sort of match up to the societal standards. Adolescents in particular have a significant pressure to fit in. There's a lot of body image concern that starts in adolescence as bodies develop and change at differing paces, and as peers look across their set of peers to see how they fit in and if they're matching the standard, that there's a lot of pressure to look a certain way. And there's also a normalization of dieting, that a lot of adolescents and adults as well diet, change the way they're eating, are trying to restrict their food in a certain set of ways or a certain way, that we know that those behaviors are quite common and so are confusing in this storm of trying to look a certain way and sort of trying to do the right thing with their food, trying to sort of make it all work out. And many of those messages are reinforced by the media, which is telling us how to look and what to eat and what's good and what's not and what products to buy. And there's this really strong cultural pressure that we all are surrounded by. And at the same time, not all of us have an eating disorder. So it's not just about the social environmental bubble, but that's part of it. If you move up to the psychology bubble, we look at different things that happen to people. There are different stressors in life, different questions of identity and self-image that are certainly present in the adolescent period of life development. There are different personality factors that really come to bear in this period of time. And we know that there are some specific kinds of personality factors that put some people at risk for eating disorders more than others. And those personality factors are things that really, when used well, are great personality traits. When hijacked by an eating disorder, are not so terrific. So we're talking about things like perfectionism, persistence, attention to detail, trying to do the right thing. Those are all great personality factors and traits that really will serve adolescents well in their life path and their career path, but when focused on eating and weight can become quite destructive. If your perfectionism is hijacked and really focused on what you're eating, how you're eating, who's seeing you eat, that can have a really negative outcome. If your perfectionism is more focused on doing well in school and doing a good job, that works out better. So we know that things like perfectionism, persistence, this ability to focus on things, attention to detail can really bode well for people, but also can be a risk factor. And then there's a risk factor involved with anxiety and depression, that the parts of the brain that we see show up in anxiety and depression are commonly overlapping with eating disorders. We're all looking at this sort of area in the brain now as our neurobiology understanding advances to understand what happens in the brain and how different people experience things differently, which really leads us into biology, because we all have stressors, we all have different personality factors, and again, not all of us have eating disorders. So we go to the third bubble of biology and look at what happens in the body, particularly when people change the way that they eat. So if somebody starts restricting their food intake or starts restricting a certain food group, starts dieting essentially, I often hear this with parents of adolescents or adolescents themselves where they say, I go to the school cafeteria at lunchtime, half the people aren't eating, particularly the girls, or they're just sitting around eating a carton of fat-free yogurt and worrying about what they're eating. That there's this food restriction that we sometimes think is sort of normative in adolescence, and yet adolescents have these incredible nutritional needs in terms of developmental needs. So we really need to pay attention to when kids are starting to restrict their food intake and ask a lot of questions about what's happening. So this biology bubble has this food restriction piece that when we go on a diet, things happen in our brain that are really genetic. Our brain is sort of programmed to make sure we have enough food, and when we don't have enough food, it's programmed to drive us to think about food, which explains a bit about why people who struggle with eating disorders become obsessed with thoughts of weight and food and eating and shape and such, because their brain is really driving this attention towards food. Additionally, in that biology bubble, we have physical changes that happen in adolescence with puberty, and then later we see in women going through menopause. But really, in the adolescent phase, puberty development is an enormous sea change for an adolescent's body, and it's also mediated by all these cultural pressures to look a certain way. So we know that as puberty sets in, there are neurotransmitters, and the whole neurobiology perspective of the brain is really impacted by a limitation in food intake. So if you take those three bubbles together, we have the social pressure, we have these personality factors and stressors, and this food restriction, and the genetic changes and the pubertal changes from a biological perspective, all of that can create a perfect storm that might look something like a well-functioning adolescent who does well in school, who's always been well-liked and seemingly fit in with their peers, goes on a diet just like all of her other peers, goes on the diet, becomes really obsessed with the diet, becomes captivated with the diet, starts to lose weight, starts to withdraw from friends and family, starts to become more and more isolated, continues to lose weight, perhaps over-exercises, and it turns into this spiral into the eating disorder that we see very commonly when people present for treatment. That a previously well-functioning, high-energy kid essentially presents as an isolated shell of themselves. And so it gives us information about why that might have happened, but it also gives us information of what we should do about it. So if we move to the next slide with sort of who gets an eating disorder, we know a bit more about why, but who, this slide is really, really sort of depicting the concept that people with eating disorders come in all sizes and shapes. You can't tell by looking at somebody whether or not they have an eating disorder, and it's a common sort of misperception that you can look at somebody and see that they're overweight and or underweight rather, and know something about their health and understanding whether they have an eating disorder or not if they're underweight. But really, we know that people with eating disorders can be any size or shape, and most people with an eating disorder are actually normal weight or higher weighted. The people who struggle with anorexia nervosa make up a smaller percentage of people with eating disorders, so we need to make sure that we're not judging a person's health just by their appearance and asking a lot of questions, and that eating disorders also don't discriminate on ethnicity, gender, race, anything else, that eating disorders impact people across the spectrum. And so we need to be sure to be asking a lot of questions and really paying attention to what we're seeing if we feel like we have some concern. So the next slide is sort of the what of eating disorders. What are eating disorders? And the next set of slides, a lot of technical information about eating disorders, and I want to highlight a couple of different pieces of the diagnostic criteria. So the diagnostic criteria is set up in what we call the DSM, which stands for the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, and we're on the fifth edition. And the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, or the DSM, sets up the different classes of eating disorders. So we know now that we have these different classifications of eating disorders, including anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, something called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, called ARFID for short, and then this relatively catch-all category called feeding and eating conditions not elsewhere classified. And there are some atypical presentations or some subclinical presentations in there, and we'll walk through those a bit. But the take-home message is that there really are these sort of five categories of an eating disorder. So I'm going to walk through a bit on each of the categories and highlight a few of the things that are particular with each of those categories of eating disorder. So the first one is anorexia nervosa. And this is the one that people tend to be more familiar with because it tends to show up more in the media. If you're standing in the supermarket checkout lane looking at the magazines that are on the end caps, you often will see a story about a celebrity that's lost weight and perhaps they have anorexia. And it tends to be what we think of when we think of eating disorders, as somebody who's underweight and has this relentless pursuit of thinness and has a distorted body image. And so we know that people with anorexia typically limit their food intake, they eat small quantities of a relatively narrow variety of foods. They tend to be fairly obsessed with what goes into their food. They tend to be obsessed with the amount of food. Parents will report that their adolescent suddenly becomes very concerned about the preparation of foods and how food is made, how it's served, what's in it, what are the ingredients in it, and that the concern and worry and fear related to food escalates. We know that anorexia is characterized by this pursuit of thinness, a fear or an unwillingness to maintain a healthy weight, and a distorted body image, and that parents or other adults in a young person's life can say, I'm worried about you, you're underweight, I'm worried about how you're eating, and the adolescent can say, I don't know what you're worried about, I'm huge, I'm fat, I'm not super thin, what are you worried about? And it seems such a strange contrast to what you see visually with what they're saying. And that's really concerning because we know that anorexia has a higher mortality rate than any other mental illness, and that we know that people with anorexia are up to 10 times more likely to die of their illness compared to those without anorexia. So we have to be vigilant about getting people the help that they need because anorexia can be a life-threatening illness. There's still some misperceptions in the media that somehow eating disorders are a choice or that they're not a real illness, and that's just simply not true. That we know that these are brain-based biological disorders that happen through this interaction of biology, social, environmental factors, and psychology, and we know what to do for treatment. We know how to help people become well. And brushing it aside as sort of a teenage phase or just a simple obsession with food is not going to work. So the next slide really highlights the DSM-5 specific criteria, and I'm not going to walk through each of the criteria other than to say that there are two types of anorexia, which can be confusing for people, because there's a restricting subtype, which is what people often think about with anorexia, where people are restricting their food intake. They have an intense fear of gaining weight. They have behavior that interferes with weight gain, and there's this sort of persistent lack of recognition of the seriousness of weight. In the restricting subtype, people are restricting their food intake and perhaps over-exercising, but they're not engaging in any sort of binge eating or purging behavior. The other subtype of anorexia are people who are engaging in episodes of binge eating or purging disorder. It might be through self-induced vomiting, it might be through misuse of laxatives or diuretics or enemas or diet pills. So there are these two types of anorexia, anorexia restricting subtype, anorexia binge eating purging type. And the binge eating purging type can be confusing when it sounds a bit like bulimia, which we're going to move on to next, but the difference between binge eating purging subtype anorexia and bulimia really is this low weight and body image distortion. So if you're dealing with a situation where somebody is at a significantly low weight, fearful of gaining weight, continuing to not recognize the seriousness of it, that's what characterizes anorexia. The pieces that characterize bulimia, you will often see some of the same worry about weight, the same worry about weight and shape, but often people are more in a normal range for their age and weight and can't be identified, as the slide said, by their outward appearance. But they still feel those similar things about fearful about gaining weight, wanting to desperately lose weight, and can be intensely unhappy with their weight and shape. And so the behaviors involved in bulimia are really characterized by these recurrent and frequent episodes of binge eating and purging. And binge eating is really defined as eating an amount of food that is unusually large in a short period of time and feeling out of control over eating. And oftentimes people will say, oh, Thanksgiving in our country is just like one big binge eating fest. And is that what you're talking about? And that's not the kind of eating that we're talking about. Binge eating associated with eating disorders is really characterized by amounts of food that are unusually large given the circumstance and people feeling really out of control with the behavior and wanting it not to be happening, but finding themselves unable to stop the behavior on their own. And those binging behaviors are typically followed by some sort of compensatory behavior, we call them, could be purging, it could be fasting, skipping meals, it could be laxative abuse, it could be excessive exercise. And many people with bulimia struggle with keeping these behaviors a secret, and because of that have these intense feelings of shame and disgust. And I will often say that in our culture, you have to keep in mind that eating disorders are really the extreme variations of normal human behavior. It is not unusual to sit down in a break room at any employer across our country and listen to people talk about their diets and talk about weight loss and talk about the latest and greatest thing they did to lose weight. And so that's not an eating disorder, but that sort of thought about losing weight If you take that all the way to the extreme and become obsessed with losing weight and obsessed with what you're eating, that's where the eating disorder behaviors live. So people are used to sort of hearing about restrictive eating. There are very few people who would sit down at that same lunch table in that same break room at that same corporation and talk about vomiting after they eat as a means of weight control. That people just simply don't talk about it. It happens, and there are lots of reports of people inducing vomiting after eating in the way of eating disorder behaviors, but it has such a feeling of shame and disgust that people are really reluctant to offer up the information. And as a result, people who struggle with binge eating and purging and bulimia really hesitate to come forward with it because they feel so shameful about it. So that's one of the differences, whereas people with anorexia, we tend to see the low weight, we tend to wonder what's wrong, we tend to ask them questions about their eating because we see that they're not eating, and we worry about what's happening. Whereas people with bulimia, you might not know that your adolescent or the person sitting next to you is struggling with an eating disorder based on how they're eating because their body might not trigger this automatic warning feeling in you. So if we look through the DSM for bulimia, there really are these highlighted areas, recurrent episodes of binge eating, recurrent inappropriate behaviors to prevent weight gain from the binge eating. There's a time period around bulimia that these behaviors happen once a week for 3 months that characterizes the illness. And that the self-evaluation, similarly to anorexia, is really unduly influenced by body shape and weight, meaning who I am is really tied up with what my body weight and shape looks like. So those are sort of the highlights of anorexia and bulimia. Then we move on to binge eating disorder, which is similar to bulimia, except it doesn't have the compensatory behaviors that bulimia does. So the binge eating is similar, that people are eating in a large amount of food in a way that feels really out of control and feeling lots of shame and guilt about it and disgust about it, but are not compensating for the binge eating in some way, like in bulimia. The really interesting part is that we know that binge eating disorder and compulsive overeating, or this sort of compulsion to eat, are more common than anorexia and bulimia across our population. And that holds true in adolescents as well, that we tend to think of sort of overweight as the problem related to obesity, but really there's a subsection of people who are struggling with weight that are struggling with an eating disorder, not just struggling with an energy imbalance. So the DSM-5, or the criteria for binge eating disorder, is a similar set in terms of the binge eating to bulimia without the compensatory mechanisms, and this really is marked to stress that binge eating is happening in the way that it is, and it's happening again once a week for 3 months. So we have anorexia, bulimia, binge eating, and then we move into our sort of catch-all categories of the feeding and eating conditions not elsewhere classified or the not otherwise specified. And they can be sort of sub-threshold bulimia, atypical anorexia, sub-threshold binge eating disorder. It's a collection of kind of other eating disorder behaviors that fall into this other category. The thing to remember is that when somebody's getting an eating disorder diagnosis, that if they get this not otherwise specified diagnosis or not elsewhere classified, it's not any less serious. That we know that across the spectrum of eating disorders, anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, and this other category, that they are all extremely serious and can be life-threatening. So that's one of the really important things to think about as a parent if you're bringing in an adolescent for an assessment, that even if they get an eating disorder diagnosis that's sort of this other specified diagnosis, doesn't make it any less serious. Which brings me to how do you know when to take somebody in for an assessment? What are the factors that would trigger you to refer as a professional to a specialist or as a parent to get some more information or to get an assessment? So if we move on to slide 17, the signs and symptoms of eating disorders, there are quite a few signs and symptoms here. I'm just going to highlight a few of them. But again, eating disorders are marked by these extremes that are related to food and weight and body and size and shape, extremes in emotions and attitudes, preoccupations and motivations. And you will often hear people talk about their preoccupations or their thoughts about weight and about food and about shape in conversation, and you'll hear the cues of excessive dieting or excessive worry sometimes. Sometimes you'll see some physical signs, sometimes you'll see some emotional signs, and sometimes you'll see these behavioral signs. So if we take the behavioral signs first, there's some of the things that we've been talking about, dieting or sort of food intake that seems rather chaotic, that somebody will seem to eat a lot at one point and then seem not to eat much at another point, or they're always restricting their food intake, or they always seem to be overeating, that something just feels odd about their food intake. And at the same time, they're preoccupied with food, with weight, with shape, with size, talking about losing weight, talking about their bodies, asking questions of, is my body, am I fat, am I underweight, am I overweight, what do you think about my body, really being obsessed with the appearance. A lot of times people notice excessive exercise, that people are exercising at all sorts of day hours of the day and night. With athletes, we see this often where athletes are working out and competing with their sports team, but then they're also doing additional exercise on their own that's not recommended by their coach, but yet they're doing it anyway. Sometimes you'll see frequent trips to the bathroom if people are purging or using diuretics or laxatives. Sometimes people change the way they're dressing, either to hide their body or to reveal their body. But it really has this isolation theme to it, that a lot of times people with an eating disorder, struggling with eating disorder behaviors, are eating alone or have already eaten or are trying to eat where they're not with other people so that they can eat in a particular way. And if they are eating with other people, it becomes a difficult situation. And families often notice this when adolescents start not showing up at family meals or always have an excuse for why they're not at a family meal or why they need to eat in a different way. Then with the physical signs, you can sometimes see unusual or rapid weight fluctuations. People may seem low energy, they have interrupted sleep, they may complain of all sorts of physical sort of diffuse complaints, GI discomfort or bloating. Sometimes you'll notice people have really dry skin, their hair texture changes, and oftentimes adolescents will complain about their hair not being as healthy, and that might be a sign of an eating disorder. In more advanced cases, you can see hair loss or the development of lanugo, which is this sort of hair, long hair on the arms. That's an attempt to keep the body warm. For females, there can be a disruption in menstruation. There can be chest pain or sort of racing heartbeat that sometimes people will experience. And the physical signs are tricky and complicated because they may be eating disorder related and they may be something else. So it really requires some good medical intervention to figure out what's happening. In the emotional area, this is where families often comment about their children, that they're seeing increased mood swings that are out of character, increased isolation or irritability, more complaints about the body, sort of a heightened perfectionistic focus, maybe sadness or comments about feelings of worthlessness, increased symptoms of this depression or anxiety or obsessive compulsive symptoms. So this diffuse set of signs and symptoms can be what triggers people to take their child into a physician or to a therapist and ask the questions of, you know, what's happening. So when does it become an eating disorder is often the question I get asked. How do we know the line between eating disorder behaviors or just sort of maybe a little bit of eating disorder behaviors versus a full-blown eating disorder diagnosis? That we really look at, as slide 18 says, you know, what are the key indicators? Is there a pattern of behaviors? Is there a lot of preoccupation with food? One of the main questions we ask people at an intake is, what percentage of the day are you thinking about shape and weight and food? And people struggling with an eating disorder will often say a very high percentage, and sometimes even when they're sleeping. We also ask about impairment. Is the shame or the fear or the behaviors, is it getting in your way of functioning? And I like this slide on number 19 that sort of shows the physical signs and behaviors of an eating disorder are really like the tip of an iceberg, that if we could look below the surface of the water and see the energy and the mental preoccupation and that is characteristic of an eating disorder, it's really much more than just the physical signs and symptoms we can see. And some of those behavioral sort of mental preoccupation or behavioral changes can be the over-focus on body weight and size. And again, it's tricky to understand if that's an eating disorder or not in this context of our society that's pretty obsessed with food and weight and eating as it is. So we really look for those mood and social changes in combination with the other issues that we see with eating pattern changes and diet talk and such. Sometimes parents or teachers will see a change at school. Often it takes a while before somebody's academic status will be impacted by an eating disorder because of the perfectionistic tendencies of many people with eating disorders. They sort of push themselves to maintain this high level of performance even when it's difficult and taxing to be that focused. They're able to maintain a fairly strong performance, but over time, teachers are often will notice just some diffuse changes that seem to worry them, that maybe the students are avoiding the lunchroom, or there's frequent requests to use the bathroom, or they're coming late to class, or they have a short attention span in class, or there's less concentration, more forgetfulness. Sometimes a failure to initiate or complete simple tasks, but often, again, people are doing okay in school, so these are really difficult sometimes to see. one of the things we do see is sort of this inflexible thinking, that if you take a brain that's not well-nourished, that brain is going to have a harder time shifting from one topic to another. And that would happen with anybody, with any of us. Even when we're, you can think about it for yourself, when you're hungry, it becomes hard to focus on what the task at hand is because your brain is trying to get you to focus on getting some food. So the inflexible thinking can show up as people progress in the eating disorder. And you may, as we said before, see some changes in weight or see changes in affect. When we look at physical changes, the things that we're looking for in physical medicine realm are the rapid weight fluctuations if those are happening. If there's a deviation from growth charts, that we often in an assessment will look at an adolescent's growth chart and see if are they continuing to grow as expected, or have they fallen off the growth chart and had a big dip, or have they gone above their growth chart and had a big increase in a way that's unanticipated. And so we really look at growth charts to give us some information about what's happening with the person's weight and development. We also will look at specific cradiac measures of bradycardia or seeing heart rate and changes in EKG, which is a heart tracing, to really understand what might be happening physically. There's a great resource on the Academy for Eating Disorders website that is listed on the slide here on slide 22 that's called the Critical Points for Early Recognition and Medical Risk Management in the Care of Individuals with Eating Disorders. That's very helpful if you're working with a physician. If you're a family working with a physician, it can be helpful to direct the physician to this resource for more information, particularly in areas where there isn't readily available eating disorder specialty treatments, because physicians are often at a loss for what to do in the case of an eating disorder. So this can be a helpful resource that was compiled by physicians and written for physicians. In terms of what parents might see, that's one of the things that I tell parents. You know, if something seems off with your child, trust your gut instinct. Trust your knowledge of your child. Parents are the best indicators and sort of have the most information about their adolescent because they know their adolescent. So if something feels not right with your adolescent, have it checked out. Ask the questions. If you're seeing more isolation or weight changes or skipping meals or eating alone or more dieting or more fatigue or any of these personality changes, and your gut instinct is that something's not quite right, that's the time to take an adolescent in for an assessment and see if there's something going on. And if there's not, if the adolescent doesn't have an eating disorder, if it's something else, at least you'll know and can move on. But staying in that doubt about, I wonder if something's wrong and I don't know if this is normal, that it's not normal for any of our kids really to be so worried about their food and their weight and their eating that it disrupts their day-to-day thinking and functioning. And with the high lethality of eating disorders, we want to take these concerns very seriously. So the slide on number 24 gives some helpful hints, hopefully, on how to start a conversation. And it can be difficult to start the conversation with somebody that you're worried about. So I encourage people to focus on their worry rather than the symptoms at hand. Because if you're coming up to somebody and saying, I'm worried about you, this is why I'm worried about you, I'm curious as to what you think about my worry about you, it really gives the person a chance to respond in a different way than, I think you have an eating disorder and we need to do something. Each person is going to have to decide for themselves how to really intervene with their particular adolescent in question. But one of the places to start from that seems universally helpful is that place of compassion. And I really encourage people to start from that place and say, this is what I'm worried about. Can I ask you some questions and can we have a conversation? There's a screening questionnaire that can be used in physician offices called the SCOF, and each of the letters in the title SCOF stands for one of the words in the question. But the six questions that are listed on slide 24 really try to get at the eating disorder behaviors. So the questions like, do you feel like you sometimes lose or lost control over how much you eat, how you eat, have you ever made yourself sick, do you believe yourself to be fat, and so on and so forth. That if you go through those lists of questions and you get an answer of yes to two of those questions or more, it strongly indicates the presence of an eating disorder. And so it gives some quick way to look at the situation and say, okay, this needs more intervention and more attention. And I would say clinically, even if you have a yes to one of those questions, you want to follow up with more information and some intervention. So in terms of the timeliness of intervention, a lot of times people don't quite recognize that they're ill and they may be ambivalent about accepting treatment, but as parents and guardians of adolescents are really the front lines of help seekers for their children, and that we as professionals need to trust parents' concerns, and parents need to trust their own instincts about their concerns. And most importantly, families and parents need to understand that they did not cause an eating disorder, and the child or family member did not choose to have it. Having an eating disorder and having an adolescent with an eating disorder is similar to an adolescent with any other illness, that a family did not cause the illness, and at the same time, the family can be incredibly helpful in helping that adolescent recover. And we know that getting treatment within a few years of onset is directly related to a higher rate of recovery. So we really want people to be getting the assessments that they need so they can understand if more eating disorder treatment is in order. When you move on to slide 26, that one of the things that I hear often, parents will say, well, I think we're just kind of going to wait it out and see what happens. Maybe it's just an adolescent phase. Maybe it's just sort of dieting that everybody's doing. And I really encourage parents to not wait for it to pass, because you could be waiting for it to pass, and in the meantime, this life-threatening illness could be strengthening and developing. That it really requires a multidisciplinary team with therapy and nutrition counseling and medicine to really help people move through eating disorder treatment so that they can get the nutrition they need, which is the number one medicine for treatment, and the therapeutic interventions they need to help manage the situation. So we really encourage people to take that next step to have an assessment to better understand what's happening. And then if there's eating disorder present, there are a number of different treatment options and levels of care. For adolescents, the most important line of treatment is family involvement. There's a therapy called family-based treatment that really incorporates the family into treatment and uses the family as a frontline intervention and defense, and parents and families are incredibly important in this process. When that as an outpatient is not adequate to interrupt the symptoms and address the eating disorder, there are higher levels of care that could be residential or it could be a day treatment. There are a number of different options, so we really strongly believe that families need to be in that first line of treatment and support, because in treatment we're really trying to do a number of things. And slide 28 sort of lists a number of things we're trying to focus on. We're trying to help people eat and be active in line with their body's needs. We're trying to help them eat when hungry, stop when satisfied, be eating foods that fulfill their nutritional needs without being afraid. We want to have a focus on health that's helpful, not harmful. We want people to be able to appreciate their bodies in a new way and not just have to try to match them up to their social standards. And we also want to employ adaptive coping skills to really manage the own distinct neurobiology that we all have. And if we think about it, each of us has our sort of own unique set of things that we have to manage. Some of us are more anxious. Some of us struggle with depression. We all have the brains we have, and we need support in managing how our brains react to the world in the way that works best for us. And families can be incredibly instrumental in helping adolescents develop those coping skills. So the other members of the team, in addition to the family, that will often be a part of eating disorder treatment involve a dietitian, a therapist, and a physician. And on slide 29, we see just a quick breakdown of sort of who does what, when, and how often do they do it. The dietitians are really helpful in meal planning and nutrition education and helping to understand what a healthy weight range for an adolescent is, giving some education about the physical aspects of eating disorders, really strategizing food-related activities, helping families understand what their adolescent needs and how to provide for them, and really working in some of those body image and coping skill areas, which overlaps a bit with the therapist, who's really assessing and treating the symptoms of the related diagnoses, be it anxiety or depression, helping the family to help the adolescent manage the different challenges they have. Therapists are also monitoring and addressing self-injury thoughts or suicidal thoughts, really helping families and individuals to understand the underlying factors in this eating disorder, this complicated sort of perfect storm of biology and sociocultural and psychology, and really helping people to master and harness their own helpful, sort of most helpful coping skills to deal with their own neurobiology at hand. And then physicians are really involved in the medical monitoring to make sure that adolescents are as medically stable and healthy as they move through treatment as possible, with, again, food being the first-line medicine and education being really important in terms of families and individuals understanding the physical aspects of eating disorders. So I'm going to quickly go through just the different options for treatment, highlighting a few things. In outpatient, I spoke a bit about that can really be the first-line intervention using families and helping to incorporate families into into treatment and helping to refeed their adolescents or helping to stabilize the behaviors of their adolescents. There are all number of interventions that in outpatient. There are groups that adolescents can do. There are different connections that families can make. There's some multi-family programming. So really seeking to connect families and individuals in a supportive environment. The next step up the ladder from that is intensive outpatient program, which is generally about a three-hour-a-day program that involves a meal. So it's a supported meal on site at a treatment program, heavily involves families again, and can be very helpful when adolescents and their families need more structure than an outpatient program can provide. The next step up the ladder is partial hospitalization or intensive day treatment, which is similar to IOP in that it's at a treatment facility. It's usually about 6 to 8 hours a day versus 3 hours a day, and it allows for more successful symptom interruption, more frequent intensive group therapy, greater involvement of families and a support network. But the bottom line is really helping people to reestablish normal healthy eating patterns, to restore weight if they need to, and to make sure that they're getting the optimal nutrition they need, as well as helping the adolescents to develop those coping skills and approach to their own needs that will be helpful for long-term recovery. The highest rung on the ladder would be residential and inpatient care. There's 24/7 support that really helps completely interrupt symptoms because there's somebody there supervising 24 hours a day. And the lengths of stay vary based on medical concerns and needs. The message really is that there are all sorts of levels of care and all sorts of options for families to engage with their adolescents in treatment. And the one that's right for one person might not be right for the next person, that there's really needs to be a strong focus on what the individual family and adolescent needs. And also, like slide 34 says, that treatment really needs to be specific for adolescents. It needs to be developmentally appropriate for adolescent cognitive level, needs to be to address the reality that sometimes adolescents aren't really all that interested in being there for treatment and that are having a hard time really finding the motivation to change the position. It's part of the illness that people with an eating disorder often feel less distressed about their eating disorder behaviors than other people do, because in some way the eating disorder behaviors are becoming a coping skill that the adolescent can be reluctant to give up. So a lot of support and changing the pattern and dynamic is very important. So as a support person, one of the most important things you can do, as slide 36 illustrates, is really reinforcing hope that recovery from an eating disorder is possible. People get better. It takes a while. That treatment is not a linear sort of progression, that it takes a while. There are fits and starts, and that we know that people can get better and that people can go on and lead full lives without an eating disorder. That really needs the support and the reinforcing of hope. Sometimes it can be helpful, as slide 37 indicates, to externalize the eating disorder in terms of really remembering that nobody chooses to have an eating disorder, that the eating disorder behaviors, which can be incredibly frustrating as an adult and incredibly worrisome, that are driven by biological, psychological, and social factors, that those behaviors are just part of the person and require strong consequences and attention and intervention, that the person is just like anybody with any other illness, that they're doing the best they can, they need our support, and they need the support they need to live in a culture that is really not very forgiving when it comes to having a positive relationship with weight and body and shape. Again, those are sort of extreme eating disorders, they're extreme levels of sort of normal societal discontent with our body. But that somebody in recovery really needs to understand how their body works and what they need. And lastly, I think just what we could do as a larger society in this sort of sociocultural soup we live in about weight and shape and eating, that we could really rethink relationships with food and body image. And Diane Newmark Steiner, who's a professor at the University of Minnesota, has done an incredible amount of research looking at how do we help teenagers maintain healthy lifestyles without increasing their risk for eating disorders. So we know that modeling good behavior with food, and modeling that behavior simply means focusing on overall health, not on weight, focusing on balance and on moderation, focusing on value as a person, not just on appearance, that talking less and doing more is really the take-home message, that if we are, as adults, modeling eating well, taking care of ourselves, getting enough rest, getting enough sleep, having a positive relationship with our body, instead of modeling dieting or food restriction or having a negative relationship with our body, where we talk about our bodies in unhelpful and sort of cruel ways. If we could really, the society, think about our bodies for the functions they have, the health that we are seeking, not just about weight, because we know that, and we believe that people should know they have worth regardless of their weight, regardless of where they fit into society. So I'm going to end there and pass it back to Tom. There are a number of resources in the last slide where you can get more information about eating disorders and some links to some of the pieces that I addressed in the presentation. So, Tom, I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you, Doctor. And, ladies and gentlemen, to help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in the survey. After I finish reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key, followed by the number that corresponds with your choice. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. This session provided me with a better understanding of the who, what, and why of eating disorders. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly agree. Again, this session provided me with a better understanding of who, what, and why of eating disorders. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause just a moment. Question number 2. This session educated me on a variety of treatment interventions to assist adolescents who suffer from eating disorders. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Again, question number 2. This session educated me on a variety of treatment interventions to assist adolescents who suffer with eating disorders. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. And Star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause just a moment. Question number 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. And Star 4, strongly disagree. Again, question number 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. And Star 4, strongly disagree. Question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1, if you agree. Star 2, if you do not agree. Again, question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 for agree. Star 2, do not agree. We'll pause just a moment. Question number 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Or Star 4, other. Again, question number 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Or Star 4, other. And that does conclude our survey for today. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd now like to move into the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question at this time, it is star 1 on your touchtone telephone. Please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that's star 1 at this time if you'd like to ask a question. We'll pause just a moment. Again, ladies and gentlemen, that's star 1 at this time if you'd like to ask a question. And ladies and gentlemen, we do have a question coming through. Please state your name before posing your question.
Nancy. And my question is, what happens as far as if your child has something that's noted on that, does that continue on their health record forever and ever? Is that something that, you know, if it's addressed, that that is somehow after a while kind of falls off? Or I'm just trying to understand about, I think that's one of the concerns as a parent is if something is addressed, but is it later on, you know, always going to be held in their record that they, at least they admitted that they had an issue?
Thanks, Nancy. That's a good question. I think it probably depends a bit on the practitioner. I mean, in theory, any illness we seek medical treatment for will be in our medical record, just like your child's immunization records, or if your child had, you know, leukemia as a child, that would be in their medical record, you know, forever in theory. I think what your question is really addressing is sort of the unfortunate stigma that still exists,
yes,
with mental health issues. Yeah.
Yes, because this is so broad, this definition. I mean, so many people could fall under this with, you know, if you're, and one of the definitions you gave was people who like to talk about food. Well, you know, if you like to talk about food as a person, I could see where in general that might be in a category. And so I'm wondering if, you know, someone as a practitioner diagnoses somebody with that, and then it turns out to be that maybe that's not the case, is that, you know, type of thing on their record forever? And is that therefore something that you need to address with the medical professional to, you know, if you question whether or not that's in fact the situation?
Yeah, I think with any diagnosis that a health professional is making, you always as a patient have a right to ask and to question that. I do think, I just want to clarify that the diagnostic criteria are actually quite intensive. And so if you think about the high percentage of people in our society that worry about their weight or talk about dieting or something like what you're referring to, people who like to talk about food, that's a high number, but the percentage of people with eating disorders is quite low compared to that. So if we're looking at that, you know, 8% of adolescent girls and 4% of adolescent boys, it's really the diagnoses are meant to be very specific and to not not misdiagnose people to the extent possible, so that we're really only diagnosing people with eating disorders that actually have an eating disorder and then that get treatment for that. Seeking an assessment for a potential eating disorder, that would just be an initial psychological assessment and has a fair array of things that people get asked about, similar to a preventative health check where you get asked a wide array of questions about different health behaviors. So I appreciate the concern that we might give somebody a diagnosis that isn't true, but I think that our diagnostic criteria are specific enough.
Well, thank you for the answer. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, that's star 1 on your touchtone telephone if you'd like to ask a question today. Star 1 at this time, please. And we have no further questions at this time.
I'd like to thank everyone for attending today and also extend a thank you to Dr. Jillian Lampert for providing us with such wonderful insights today. If anyone on the call has specific questions about any of the topics discussed today, please contact the Eating Disorder team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. And please also mark your calendars to join us next month on Tuesday, June 24th, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when the topic will be related to eating disorder advice for family, friends, and treatment professionals. Thank you all for attending and have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. We appreciate your participation.